Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present David Gans of the Constitutional Accountability Center, who assesses the Supreme Court challenge to the Voting Rights Act and the consequences if the law is overturned. Excerpts of a speech by civil rights attorney and legal scholar Michelle Alexander, who talks about her book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Color Blindness. And Nathan Fuller of the Bradley Manning Support Network, who discusses Private First Class Manning's decision to plead guilty to 10 charges and his court statement explaining his motivation for releasing classified U.S. documents to WikiLeaks. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Human Rights Watch is charging the Sri Lankan government with an ongoing campaign of rape and other forms of sexual violence against suspected supporters of the defeated Tamil Tigers rebel movement. In 2009, the Sri Lankan army brutally crushed the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam's guerrilla army. Over 100,000 people were killed during the 26-year civil war. During the past year, the Sri Lankan government has come under growing criticism, including a series of hearings before the United Nations Human Rights Council. Sri Lankan President Rajapaksa has shown little interest in investigating past human rights abuses, including extrajudicial killings. A Human Rights Watch report documents 75 cases of alleged sexual abuse and torture from 2006 to 2012 based on individual interviews and medical records. The report, which the Sri Lankan government described as lies and rubbish, documents a consistent pattern of sexual abuse and torture of Tamil detainees. At the center of the shale oil boom in North Dakota, three small native tribes living on the lucrative Bakken shale oil deposits have gone to federal court to win back rights to the rich resources under their land. Over the last decade, members of three tribes on Fort Berthold Indian Reservation, the Mandan, the Hidatsa, and the Arikara, signed low-priced oil leases with a syndicate run by Spencer Wilkinson, manager of the local Indian casino. Wilkinson teamed up with a billionaire hedge fund manager and the oil service giant Schlumberger to develop shale oil on the reservation. Tex Hall, current chairman of the three affiliated tribes, told ProPublica, "Hundreds of millions of dollars were lost. It's just a huge loss, and we will never get it back." 2 years after Wilkinson and his partners launched their enterprise, they sold it for $950 million after only paying $14 million to the tribes. Oil companies and the federal government have long sought to exploit the rich oil supply that lay beneath Fort Berthold Indian Reservation, with estimated reserves of 20 billion barrels of crude oil. Efforts to exploit the oil reserves in the 1970s and 1990s failed. Only with the emergence of newer hydraulic fracturing or fracking technology did the oil boom come to North Dakota. Individual tribal members have sued Wilkinson and his partners in federal court in Bismarck, claiming they were victims of the biggest swindle of Native Americans in U.S. history. Since the Citizens United Supreme Court decision opened up the floodgates for corporate money in politics, shareholder activists have pressed corporate CEOs to disclose their political spending. The campaign run by the Center for Political Accountability has advocated for transparency and increased corporate disclosure. Center President Bruce Fried commented, "Hidden political spending soared off the charts in the 2012 election, but a steadily increasing number of companies are choosing an alternative." Mobile technology giant Qualcomm is the latest company to include fees paid to trade associations in its public disclosure. In 2013, shareholder activists filed over 50 resolutions advocating for public disclosure of corporate political spending and lobbying fees at blue-chip companies like 3M, Aetna, AT&T, and JP Morgan. At Visa's recent shareholders meeting, 37% of shareholders supported tougher disclosure standards. So far in 2013, several big corporations, including KeyCorp, Harley-Davidson, and Deere, have agreed to disclose their political spending. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
One of the major accomplishments of America's civil rights movement is under attack. The 1965 Voting Rights Act passed into law to prevent local and state governments from disenfranchising minority voters is being challenged before the U.S. Supreme Court by Shelby County, Alabama, whose officials assert that the law is an anachronism no longer needed in the post-racial South and an unconstitutional infringement on state sovereignty. The plaintiffs in this case, supported by the conservative Project on Fair Representation, are specifically challenging the constitutionality of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which requires federal preclearance of new voting laws proposed by jurisdictions with a history of discrimination. Section 5 currently applies to 9 states and parts of 7 additional states with a record of discrimination at the polls. While many jurisdictions have applied for and been granted exemptions from the preclearance requirement after 10 years of good behavior, Shelby County, with its poor record on voting discrimination, is not eligible. Although the Supreme Court has upheld the Voting Rights Act on 4 previous challenges, and the law was overwhelmingly renewed by Congress in 1970, 75, 82, and 2006, some observers are concerned that the Supreme Court's conservative majority may be poised to overturn the landmark civil rights legislation. Your reporter spoke with David H. Gans, director of the Human Rights, Civil Rights, and Citizenship Program at the Constitutional Accountability Center. Here he assesses the continued relevance of the Voting Rights Act and the consequences if the law is overturned.
Congress is the body that, under the Constitution, has the authority to prevent interracial discrimination. In 2006, they looked at the state of voting discrimination across the country, and they still found racial discrimination voting was concentrated, in places like Alabama. So, for example, in Selma in the 90s, as African Americans became a demographic majority, there were efforts to dilute their voting strength. And I think what you see, and if you look at the examples Congress found, was as African Americans, as Latinos were growing in numbers and ready to exercise political power, there were efforts to deny their voting rights. You know, one sort of prickly stark example in Mississippi, in a town of Killmichael, there was even an attempt to cancel election when it appeared that African Americans were going to succeed at the polls, and preclearance was the remedy that blocked these efforts. So there's certainly been progress, and no one doubts that there's been progress towards goal of the 15th Amendment, but Congress found the job wasn't done and that preclearance was still necessary to prevent and deter racial discrimination in states that have a history of voting discrimination. And it's particularly inappropriate for Shelby County to be bringing this challenge because they, in fact, have a very recent history of voting discrimination. And in 2008, the city of Calera, which is within Shelby County, tried to eliminate the only district that provided an opportunity for African Americans to elect candidates of their choice. And so they don't come into the court with clean hands. They come with a very recent record of voting discrimination, and you know it's significant that the first questions that Justice Sotomayor, Justice Kagan asked was, you know, why are you in court when your record is exactly why we have this critical provision?
One of the things that's often quoted about the oral arguments made before the Supreme Court justices was Justice Antonin Scalia and his comment related to what he termed as racial entitlements. Did that surprise you? Or maybe you can sort of place those comments in context for us and their importance, if any.
It was surprising, even shocking. One, protection against voting discrimination is a core right that belongs to all Americans. It's an American entitlement. It's not a racial entitlement. So calling protection for the right to vote something that should be eliminated is just contrary to the Constitution. And Scalia, who has this reputation as the great conservative who follows the text, here is ignoring that it's Congress that has the power to prevent interracial discrimination in voting.
David Gans, how do you think this challenge to the Voting Rights Act relates to the fact that in this 2012 presidential election, we saw dozens of states controlled by the Republican Party try to put up obstacles to voting for minorities, students, the elderly, with things such as onerous voter ID requirements, curtailing early voting, making registration of new voters difficult. This seems to be part of a pattern of things happening in the country. that maybe speaks to a concern of the Republican Party of the changes in the demographics of voters, where maybe they fear that without manipulating who's going to go to the polls, they will have a harder time getting elected.
So the first point that you mentioned is the 2012 elections really shows why the Act's protections against racial discrimination in voting are so critical. And what you saw in the run-up to the election was that courts with judges across ideological spectrum blocked these new voter suppression measures. So in Texas, the voter ID law that was the most stringent in the nation was blocked by a three-judge court applying the preclearance provisions of the Voting Rights Act. In Florida, the cutbacks on early voting were also blocked by the preclearance requirement of the Voting Rights Act. So we saw why this protection is so critical, and because preclearance had to be satisfied, the right to vote for racial minorities was in play and enforced for the election, and these restrictions didn't go into effect. So I think that's, you know, one, it shows it's the critical nature of preclearance, and I think one of the things you've seen is that, you know, if you look at the history of the Voting Rights Act, there's been a history of the Act and the renewals of preclearance being passed by widespread majorities, and in some ways in 2006, you know, Republicans and Democrats agreed that the right to vote is kind of at the core of what the Constitution is all about, and that this, you know, most important and successful piece of legislation needed to be continued to finish the work of realizing the promise of the 15th Amendment. And I think what you're seeing now is a shift. There's a lot of Republican opposition, a lot of conservative opposition to the Voting Rights Act, and that's reflected in sort of what you see in the court, in which you have the ideological divisions over the Constitution that play out in so many important cases. You know, there's a real question of, if this is struck down, will Congress be able to respond?
And that's pretty much the only place to go if the court does strike down the Voting Rights Act, isn't it?
I mean, in terms of providing national protection for the right to vote, you know, Congress is the one that can do that. Everyone agrees, and the premise of Shelby County's challenges, there'll still be critical parts of the Voting Rights Act that will still be in place, namely Section 2, which has a nationwide prohibition, but these special remedies that have, you know, long provided critical protection in jurisdictions with a history of voting discrimination would not be in place under a ruling that buys Shelby County's argument and says this is unconstitutional.
That was David H. Gans, Director of the Human Rights, Civil Rights, and Citizenship Program at the Constitutional Accountability Center. Find more analysis and commentary on challenges to the Voting Rights Act on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In 2010, civil rights lawyer and legal scholar Michelle Alexander published The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Color Blindness. In the book, she argues that the war on drugs, declared in the 1970s, replaced the war on poverty and created a legal way to discriminate against African Americans after the end of both slavery and legal racial discrimination in the South, known as Jim Crow. Alexander maintains that this was carried out by targeting African American communities in the search for drug dealers and drug users, even though the numbers of blacks and whites who use and sell drugs are almost equivalent. She presents evidence on how African Americans are disproportionately arrested, convicted, and imprisoned on drug charges, and how a felony conviction follows a person for the rest of his or her life, creating almost insurmountable barriers to securing employment, housing, education, and any semblance of a normal life. Alexander's book initiated a grassroots movement to better understand the consequences of the war on drugs, the plight of its victims, and to demand changes in the U.S. criminal justice system. The author recently spoke at Yale University's Divinity School on February 25th. What follows is an excerpt of her talk.
Many of us, myself included, virtually slept through a revolution, actually a counter-revolution, a counter-revolution that has blown back so much of the progress that Dr. King and Ella Baker and so many other racial justice advocates risked their lives and some even died for. This counter-revolution has occurred with barely a whimper of protest, even as millions of people, overwhelmingly poor folks of color, have been rounded up, locked in cages, and relegated to a second-class status once again. I think one day we may look back and wonder how we could have possibly slept for so long. Of course, I'm always eager to admit that my own awakening did not happen overnight. There was a time when I rejected comparisons between mass incarceration and slavery and mass incarceration and Jim Crow, and thought that people who ran around making those kinds of claims and those kinds of comparisons were actually doing more harm than good to efforts to reform our criminal justice system and achieve greater racial inequality in the United States. But after years of representing victims of racial profiling and police brutality and investigating patterns of drug law enforcement in poor communities of color, and attempting to assist people who had been released from prison try to reenter and face one legal barrier after another, attempting to reenter into a society that had never shown much use for them in the first place, I had a series of experiences that began what I now call my awakening. I began to awaken to a racial reality that is just so obvious to me now that what stuns me in retrospect is that I had managed to be blind to it for so long. As I describe in the introduction, what has changed since the collapse of Jim Crow has less to do with the basic structure of our society than the language we use to justify it. In the era of color blindness, it is no longer socially permissible to use race explicitly as a justification for discrimination, exclusion, and social contempt. So we don't. Rather than rely on race, we use our criminal justice system to label people of color criminals and then engage in all the practices that we supposedly left behind. Today, it is perfectly legal to discriminate against criminals in nearly all the ways in which it was once legal to discriminate against African Americans. Once you're labeled a felon, the old forms of discrimination, employment discrimination, housing discrimination, denial of the right to vote, exclusion from jury service, are suddenly legal. As a criminal, you have scarcely more rights and arguably less respect than a black man living in Alabama at the height of Jim Crow. We have not ended racial caste in America. We have merely redesigned it. I've given a lot of thought over the years to how we managed to be lulled to sleep and become so indifferent to the suffering of millions. And the reasons are numerous, but among the most important, I think, are the perceptions and the images of great racial progress, images that reinforce the sense that those who have been left behind, those who are stuck at the bottom, find themselves there for reasons that can be fairly described as their own fault. We hear a common narrative today, not only in mainstream media, but also in many churches, including black churches. If only black men would get it together and do right. Pull up their pants, stay in school, get a job, do right by their kids, be a man, be a real father, stay away from drugs, just act right. Then, none of this would be happening. This whole system of mass incarceration aimed at black folks wouldn't even be a problem if they would just act right. There is a sense among many black folks that sadly, we've just brought all of this on ourselves. And this perception allows waves and waves of shame and punitiveness to wash over our communities, waves that meet little resistance. And paradoxically, the election of Barack Obama, far from reflecting the liberation, the true liberation of black people in the United States, actually rationalizes, in some respects, our collective indifference to those who are locked up and locked out. You flick on the television set, and there is President Barack Obama standing in the Rose Garden, looking handsome, dignified, and in charge. You flip the channel again, and there is Michelle Obama digging a garden in the backyard of the White House, not as a slave or a servant or as a maid, but as the First Lady. You know, schooling our nation on good health and how to be good stewards of our planet. And then you flip the channel again, and there's the whole Obama family descending the stairs of Air Force One, cheered by America and around the world. So if a black man can be president of the United States today, what is wrong with you, brother? In handcuffs on your way to jail. If Obama can make it be president of the United States, why can't you? What is wrong with you?
That was Michelle Alexander, author of Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Find more perspectives on the U.S. war on drugs by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Before a military judge during a pretrial hearing at Fort Meade, Maryland on February 28th, Army Private First Class Bradley Manning pled guilty to 10 charges, facing up to 20 years in prison, while contesting 12 more serious charges for his release of hundreds of thousands of classified government documents to WikiLeaks. Imprisoned for more than 1,000 days since his arrest in May 2010, with part of that time spent in solitary confinement or under harsh conditions, the 25-year-old former intelligence analyst will face a court-martial in June on charges that include aiding the enemy that carry a maximum sentence of life in prison. Reading from a prepared 35-page statement in court, Manning explained for the first time the motivation behind his transfer of hundreds of thousands of Pentagon and State Department documents to the not-for-profit WikiLeaks media organization. Among the battle logs and diplomatic cables released by Manning was the remarkable real-time video account of a 2007 U.S. Apache helicopter assault in Baghdad that resulted in the deaths of 12 civilians, including two Reuters news staffers. Of that video and the many other documents made public, Manning explained that he hoped to spark domestic debate about U.S. foreign policy and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He said, quote, "I felt I accomplished something that would allow me to have a clear conscience." Your reporter spoke with Nathan Fuller of the Bradley Manning Support Network, a group that raises funds for Private Manning's legal defense. Here, Fuller discusses Manning's guilty pleas on 10 charges, the account of why he released classified U.S. documents, and his coming court-martial.
Bradley has offered this guilty plea, but he's made it to the judge. It's not part of an agreement with the government prosecutors. So the government prosecutors are continuing ahead with their 22 counts, and they're seeking life without parole in prison for Manning. But as he's offering his guilty plea, he supplemented that with a 35-page statement to the court, orienting the court with basic facts about his time as an intelligence analyst in Iraq and why he gave documents to WikiLeaks. And it was an incredible statement because he took full responsibility for leaking to WikiLeaks, but at the same time, it's a really a scathing indictment of the way the government has charged him, because he did it with pure motives. He wanted the American people to know about crimes and abuses done in their name, but he only chose documents that he knew as an intelligence analyst would not harm the U.S., documents recording events that had already passed and not those that would, for example, give away sources and methods or other things to come that could put soldiers in danger.
Nathan, maybe you could talk about the very interesting chronology of events that Bradley Manning recounted in the court about his attempt to get this information to various mainstream newspapers in the U.S. before he eventually released those documents to WikiLeaks.
Sure. So Bradley had decided by the time he came back to Maryland during a mid-tour leave. He was first deployed in eastern Baghdad, but then he came back to Maryland when he was on leave, and he had decided he wanted to give it to a news organization. He wanted it to give it to a big newspaper so that the American people would see it, and his first choice was the Washington Post. He was staying with his aunt's house in Maryland, and so Washington Post was the biggest paper there, and so he called an editor there or a reporter there, and the woman on the line didn't really seem that interested. She said she'd have to know more about the documents. She could talk to a higher-up editor or something and get back to him, and he didn't really feel the conversation was going anywhere. So then he went to the next big paper that he knew of, and that was the New York Times. And he called the public editor and got a voicemail answering machine, and he left a message leaving his phone number and Skype address, and no one got back to him. Nobody called him back. And so he felt that that these newspapers were not really interested. They didn't really know what he was trying to offer them, and they weren't going to do anything about it. But he had previously understood that WikiLeaks published in full documents chronicling other war crimes and other abuses. And so he, just at a little Barnes & Noble in Maryland, uploaded the Iraq and Afghanistan war logs, hundreds of thousands of pages documenting everyday events in both of those countries that that the U.S. government did not let us know about before, things such as 15,000 uncounted civilian casualties in Iraq and official policy to ignore torture and a lot of other things that that we should know about.
Is there any indication whether or not the government will pursue these more serious charges of aiding the enemy and the like in the court-martial coming in June?
They have. The judge asked if they would, following the plea, and their only real statement was, given the serious nature of the offenses that they charge, they're going ahead with all 22 counts. So they seemed totally unmoved by Bradley's plea and are continuing at the 22 counts, seeking life without parole.
So it seems that Bradley Manning may be made an example of to prevent other military soldiers from doing something similar. Is that what your sense of it is?
That's certainly what the government's hoping for. They want to set an example, but they also want to set a legal precedent. This is a brand new territory and unprecedentedly broad interpretation of this aiding the enemy. Just by giving information to a news source, you can be considered to be indirectly passing information to our enemies. But they certainly want to chill dissent and whistleblowing in the U.S. military. They certainly don't want any more Bradley Mannings. And so it'll be up to the judge, though, to see what kind of example exactly they set. Even if he is convicted of aiding the enemy, she has very wide discretion as to his sentence can be between no confinement at all and life in jail without parole. And so it'll come down to the arguments about what did Bradley intend to do and, you know, what was the effect? Did this really cause all the harm that the U.S. Says that it did?
That was Nathan Fuller of the Bradley Manning Support Network. For further discussion of the Manning case and to read the full text of his 35-page personal statement made in court, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.